Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is the political investigative reporter for the Wall Street Journal, Josh Dossey, and one of the authors of a really terrific new book, 2024, What Happened, How the Republicans Won and the Democrats Lost the Country. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. More importantly, we want you to vote on the worst of the worst from the Trump administration. We have a voting page ready to log your opinion in the show notes for this episode. We hope to announce the results next week, so there's a lot of tension. This is a week before the election, so make sure you vote early and often if you wish. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Beam, ZBiotics, and Royo in our show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it helps make this podcast happen. James, it may seem like old news, but every day there is a reminder of how awful this big, ugly bill the Republicans enacted this month, worse than we even thought when we talked about it last week. Everyone out there, you owe it to yourselves to read Larry Summers' essay in the New York Times this week titled, quote, "This Law Made Me Ashamed of My Country," end quote. The former Treasury Secretary and a brilliant economist is hardly a radical. He's often criticized, as a matter of fact, by the left wing. But after talking to his daughters, who are in medicine and social work, he asked, what should he say to seriously disabled patients who can live at home only because Medicaid pays for rides to their medical appointments now that they could lose that Medicaid coverage? Or what to say to those people who are proud and committed to comforting the lonely, poor, and elderly when their country's leaders decide more money for the most fortunate is a higher priority? Summers, whose knowledge and intelligence dwarfs anyone in this administration, notes that the Republican showcase, the much heralded work requirements actually are a fraud. They don't increase work and they do inhibit necessary care. Please read Larry Summers in the New York Times. I also would say our favorite economics correspondent, James, Catherine Rampell, and the Brennan Center's Michael Waldman point out that in this massive bill, there's anywhere from $150 billion to $178 billion for ICE, border security and enforcement. This is larger than the budgets of the FBI, drug enforcement, and U.S. Marshals combined. You know, it really does have the element of a police state, as the other day when heavily armed and masked agents carrying rifles and tactical gear swept through a park in Los Angeles trying to root out migrants. You know, also in this measure is one that limits tax deductions for gambling losses. I don't have a view on whether this is a good or a bad measure, but senior senators like Chuck Grassley, the ranking Republican on the Finance Committee, said he had no idea this was in the bill. The 91-year-old Iowa Republican may be over the bend, but other senators said the same thing. They were in the dark. This is not only the worst legislation, James, I've ever seen, but it's the sloppiest, most careless. It really is a disgrace. It gets more disgraceful the more we learn about it, James.
Well, I don't know how to say it, but you're 100% right. And I don't think we even close to finding everything that's in here. It was intentionally jammed. It intentionally passed with all Republican votes. They didn't want anybody to read it. It's pretty clear. And it's pretty clear they didn't read it. And it's pretty clear that that the Supreme Court and the Congress have agreed to just turn over any power that they were constitutionally given and just give it to the executive. And the catastrophe is so ongoing, so devastating. I literally am one of these people that just, I hope to God we get through this. But I got to tell you, I don't think it's a certainty. I don't think it's a certainty at all.
As you say, this week, the Supreme Court said, you have carte blanche to fire people. I mean, John Roberts and company really ought to register as a PAC, a Trump PAC, because they're going to let him get away with everything because they too are scared.
So, rise or something, then you cannot, you don't have to do it. I don't understand their logic.
Their logic is that they're Republicans, James. It really is. It's a partisan court. And I don't think under the same circumstances they ever would have let Biden or Obama or Clinton get away with this. I don't think there's any question of that.
Right, man. You know, but it's every institution that we have is not protected. I mean, it's pretty goddamn sad. I read the Larry Summers piece. I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was just right on the money. And they're going to be whole books coming out about this. And what people said, well, we didn't know. That you're going to hear that a lot. All right? And you're going to hear it more and more.
You know, if you're a United States senator, a United States representative, I don't think it's asking. I really don't think it's asking much to say in the most important bill of this Congress, you know what's in it. You know, I may disagree with your vote, but you at least ought to know what the hell's in it.
I think it's 1,000 pages. How big a staff does Grassley have? He could have broken it down into 100 pages each and have a verbal briefing. But, you know, all right, Senator, this is what's in this page, and this is what's here. I mean, maybe the guy's 92. I don't know. I don't know if I could sit down and read 1,000 page piece of legislation. I don't know how many people have that attention span, but given the resources they had, they could have known everything in that. They didn't want to know. You know, all right?
James, you're absolutely right. But what else they could have done? They could have had a process. They could have had witnesses. They could have had analysis. They could have taken a big bill like this. It usually takes months. I mean, you know,
right.
I mean,
you can subpoena people and people can tell
right.
you what's
they
in there.
Did it and they wanted to do it in hours. It is the most irresponsible act imaginable. And they ended up with such a crappy product in part because of that.
I mean, we're going to run against them so hard on this, and we should. All right, you didn't know what you were voted for. All right, Senator so-and-so wants re-election. This is what he voted for in the middle of the night without asking a single question. Not a one. I don't know of any of them that questioned any of this.
Tom Tillis was the only Republican that really did, and he voted against the bill. And Tillis said the other day, and I actually come in his defense, that he was so concerned with the other parts of the bill that were being misrepresented and that were going to cause such harm that he, too, missed things like the gambling laws change because there was just so much bad. I give Tillis credit, but you're right. The Grassley's and company, Grassley's run by his staff anyway, so his staff, I guess, just decided he had no need to know.
But okay, so somebody could have call, they know who Tillis is. I'm sure they'll, you know, they're buying that car because they could have said, Tom, what are you seeing this that concerns you? It could be anything you could have done. Mm-hmm. They didn't do anything, nothing. No due diligence, completely total negligence, added $3.3 trillion that we know of to the debt, all right? Cut funding for cancer research, for science, for anything that you can think of, and no one even asked a question. Not a single goddamn question that I know of. I mean, I'm sure somebody will find something. And there were people knew this. It's a 1,000-page bill. Given the resources that the United States Congress has, they could have had that bill synthesized, bullet point, processed in 3 hours. It's not that hard. It's really not. It doesn't take you to sit in your coal lamp at night, squinching your eyes to read something. They can analyze this stuff almost instantly. I can't believe it, Albert. I just can't believe it.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And James, there's a simple reason they didn't do that. They didn't want to. All they gave a damn about was passing this bill because, you know, their master, Donald Trump, said, I want it by July 4th. I don't care what's in it. It really is a disgrace.
It's a violation of the oath of office.
It is.
Well, it's a violation of what you're supposed to do. I mean, you could say, look, and even some of them say, well, there was some bad things in here, but, you know. I'd vote for it anyway. All right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Of course, they didn't take any out because the House had no choice. What about the 218 people in the United States House of Representatives that voted for it? They didn't know anything in it.
Yeah. James, with your Louisiana and Mississippi homes, you have real expertise in natural disasters and relief, the problems in the Texas Hill Country. On July 4th, there was a flash flood tragedy that's killing, it's approaching 200 now, including young girls at a camp. From what we know so far, was this avoidable? And what lessons are there for the future?
So Albert, I have a saying, whenever floodwaters recede, probably true of fires or anything else, the first thing that gets exposed is a pointing finger. Wasn't me, it was him or whoever. All right, so we're in the midst of this tragedy. What was the reason? Well, hopefully there'll be some kind of a qualified investigation and recommendations to be made. I already know. But I am going to tell you what happened. When the Confederacy lost, Jesson Davis said the Confederacy, quote, died of a theory, unquote. Of course, that theory being we don't need no government. We rebel because they had a federal government. We wanted to do. There's stories that the governor of North Carolina wouldn't give the Confederate Army uniforms or boots. I mean, it was all different things. It was a flawed theory. The theory you don't need government. And I hear people say to me at this time, well, you got to understand, our Constitution was written to limit the power of government. Actually, you're fucking wrong. It was written because we had limited government under the Articles of Confederation, and it didn't work. All right, James, well, you get to what happened in Texas. I'm getting to what happened in Texas. The theory is we don't need the government telling us where we build, how we build, what we build. We don't need any sirens going off in the middle of the goddamn night. All right? So this was the theory. So in Kerr County was built on that theory that we don't need zoning, we don't need anything, we just need hardworking people that'll come here, go to church, do their work, and live in this blessed land in the Texas Hill Country. And that you keep doing the same thing. So, the Weather Service, well, as far as I know, they got it pretty right.
Yeah,
they didn't have the communications coordinator in that. So a weather forecaster that a meteorologist knows is not any good unless the people know. Well, the people didn't know because the legislature had an idea to give a grant to build this stuff. The guy in the Texas legislature from Kerr County voted against it.
Yeah.
And then the county had a chance to put this warning in, and they said they didn't want to spend the money because that violates their theory of limited government. And then you can always count on Donald Trump to say the dumbest goddamn thing imaginable. So this Trump, who knows nothing. Okay, he said, quote, this was a 100-year event, unquote. Stop. Full stop. First of all, they don't do that anymore because that even if he's right, let's assume that this is going to happen every 100 years. Or a knowledgeable guy like this told me 100 events means there's a 16-to-1 chance it will happen in any given year. I'm not quite sure what the math is, but maybe one of our listeners can send it in and we could do it, but whatever. So let's just say once in 100. Well, you and I are 80. So there's an 80% chance we're going to drown. Is that the does that make any sense at all for him to be that goddamn stupid to say, well, it was a 100-year event? 100 years events are, and, you know, of course, I hate to say the obvious because every person that listens to the show knows what's coming out of my mouth next. With climate change, every 5 years is 100 years. So what's going to happen? They're going to be doing a timeline, and they're going to be doing this, they're going to be doing that. Of course, they're going to install the sirens. Of course, they're going to do all of that. But understand, at the bottom of this, these kids died of a theory. And people are dying every day of a stupid, jackass, Austrian theory. And that is at the bottom of what happened. I promise you.
And James, looking ahead, we're probably not going to resolve that in places like Kerr County, I'm afraid. But Trump wants to eliminate FEMA. Given climate change, my guess is over the next couple of years, if anything, these disasters may be worse. So what are you? Who takes over if you eliminate FEMA?
He doesn't have any idea. Eliminating FEMA is in service to the theory. You don't need that. The churches can do it, or some stupid shit that they say. It's not going to stop. It didn't stop in Western North Carolina. It didn't stop in Los Angeles County. It didn't stop in Kerr County. It's not going to stop. But don't worry, we have the theory of limited government. All right, that should have been the responsibility of Katrina of the state of Louisiana. All right, you're going to learn a lot about it, given area. It's all so depressingly predictable. And, you know, there's FEMA, there was a day where everybody thought, well, that was a good. And to my knowledge, they do a pretty good job. I mean, since they had that post-Katrina disaster, that most of the people that have been put in there are kind of expert at this. And that's, you know, we've done a lot of it. We know a lot. And we're just going to ditch all of that body of knowledge we have. Oh, man, it's so much more depressing than you think. That's the real thing. It's not these children died. Not as 109 confirmed and 160 missing. I hate to say this, but, you know, after this many days, if you're missing, I don't think it looks very good.
Oh.
Yeah.
It is
all they had to do. They had the correct weather forecast at 118. I think they had like a 4 or 5 hour lag time that no one knew. The freaking mayor didn't know. And there's going to have to be that if you get a weather radio, which I don't have one and no one else does, that it never goes off and you would hear the beeping siren. The weather alerts come on a cell phone. A lot of people sleep with their cell phone off. It's in a different room. I don't know. I mean, it's got to be. The best way to do it would have been for the public to pay for a system of sirens so people wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, shit, I'm getting out of Dodge. They're blowing these things for some reason. You know, I'll move and ask later. It's all so depressingly predictable.
Yeah. Well, I think you have put your finger on the blame where it lies. I want to take just one little shot at Senator Ted Cruz. Senator Ted Cruz, who famously went to Cancun when there was a huge outage in Texas years ago, was in Greece vacationing with his family. That's fine. The Senate wasn't in session. He has every right to take a vacation. The news of this came out early on July 4th, early a.m. July 4th. They're, what, probably 7 hours ahead of us there. So he had every reason to know about it mid-morning July 4th. He said he got back to Texas as quickly as he can, except at 6 p.m. on Saturday, which was much, 24, 28 hours later, he was photographed at the Pantheon. Now, Senator, I don't deny you your vacation with your family, but don't lie about it. Don't lie about it and don't say I got back and I took charge as quickly as I could. There's enough tragedy, enough lying.
Well, Maybe that son of a bitch ought to, I don't know. He goes to Cancun and the state freezes, right? He goes to Athens and people are drowning. Shit. So, but I want to address something about the laptop. They kind of insinuated, well, you know, you had to get a seat. Do you know what would have happened if Ted Cruz would have called the president of American Airlines and said, hey, man, you got to get me back to San Antonio. I'm here in Athens. Shit. Don't tell me. They didn't move.
Of course.
That's the lamest fucking excuse I ever heard in my life.
Well, that's okay? Ted.
It's so lame. And I don't know what, I don't even know if the guy is like, has a human reaction to this. I really don't. I don't know. It's just, it's very, 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 very weird.
Well,
it is that. This is, I'm sorry out there. This is a depressing segment because these are depressing developments. I want to reiterate again on the budget bill, read Larry Summers' guest essay in the Times. I am ashamed of my country. Because sadly, he has really, really nailed it.
Yeah. It feels good, man. And, we're big believers in maximizing your sleep and maximizing the tools that you have to get better sleep. And this game is a great tool for that.
Yeah, it is. Because summer is here. That doesn't mean we can slow down and take a break. Every day, there are new outrages designed to overwhelm us and take us out. So don't give in. Wake up every day ready, refreshed, and energized to take on the day. That's why we turn to Beam Dreams Powder, a natural sleep blend designed to help you get the deep, restorative sleep that your body and mind need to stay in the fight. I love the chocolate peanut butter, as you all know, but let's get into it. Thanks to science-backed ingredients like reishi magnesium, L-theanine, apiagenin, and melatonin, Dream helps you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up ready to organize, resist, and raise hell without a fog or crash. Since we started using Dream, focus comes back and our energy returns. Now we're ready to face the day and ready to stand up for the things that matter. It's become a must in most of our nightly routines to help recharge, get up, and stay engaged in what matters most. Beam Stream Powder has improved over 17.5 million nights of sleep for people across the country, so you can be one of them. So here's the deal. Right now, Beam is offering up to 40% off their best-selling Dream Powder for our listeners. It's a limited time offer and the perfect way to overcome that exhaustion and stay in the fight every day. So go to shopbeam.com and use the code WARROOM at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/WARROOM and use the code WARROOM for up to 40% off. Sleep well, wake up ready, and the fight continues. And the link, by the way, is in our show notes.
Get the sleep you need with Beam.
Hey, James, I now have read 4 books on last year's presidential elections, all worthwhile, all painful. The best, however, may be 2024, How Trump Retook the White House and Democrats Lost America. 2 co-authors are Tyler Pager and Isaac Arnsdorf. With us today is the other, Josh Darcy, who was a University of South Carolina Gamecock and now a political investigative reporter for my cherished alma mater, The Wall Street Journal. Josh, when historians look back in 2024, the main story is going to be Trump's remarkable comeback after leaving office in disgrace. And you really capture that. But my biggest takeaway, I guess, was the self-delusion of Joe Biden and team. Claiming falsely, first of all, he was the only one that could beat Trump. And they didn't even seem to raise the issue of could this old man serve for 4 more years. I'm much less interested in what the George Clooney's or donors thought than the myopic selfishness of Biden and his advisors.
That was one of our most interesting takeaways we thought too, Al, how the folks who are around Biden, his sort of core group of aides, really kept a lot of information from him, kept a lot of people from him, particularly after, you know, that debate in June, sort of the disastrous, infamous debate in June. And what we sort of found here was that there were lots of warning signs throughout the years 2023 and even early 2024, even before the debate. The Democratic Party, you know, the voters did not want Biden. The American public wanted to move on, right? And they sort of like pushed him through. And then after the debate, even as there was a clamoring by senators, members of Congress, you know, everyone sort of under the sun that it was time to go, there was a fierce effort by some of Biden's top aides, Steve Ricchetti, Mike Donilon, and others, to keep the pollsters from meeting with him, to keep campaign staff from meeting with him, to keep a lot of the data and information that they were getting from him. It was a pretty aggressive insularity there that's sort of hard to describe.
Yeah, but even in the fall of 2023, you write that some of his closest aides wanted to meet with him and talk about the peril of his candidacy. They couldn't get a meeting. Who were they, and why couldn't they get a meeting with the president?
Well, a lot of what happened there was that in that period of time, that was when the attack with Hamas happened, right? And there was talk in 2023 after his interview with Robert Herr that obviously did not go well. They were under some delusions that it wasn't that awful, but it, you know, did not go well. The numbers were really bad. They were struggling to get donors on board. They were struggling to get fundraisers on board. And there was a conversation about whether or not they should ask the president, do you really want to do this again? Do you really want to spend four more years doing this? And then the attack with Hamas happens, and they sort of never bring that conversation up to him.
Who were those that wanted to go see him and could not?
Well, I think it was a core group who had concerns were Anita Dunn in the White House. There were other aides on the campaign side that were really concerned. I think Donald and Machete were the only ones, to the best of our knowledge, of the senior folks who were really bought in on a second term and wanted to keep it going no matter what. And probably Anthony Bernal, I would also put in that category, and obviously the First Lady.
Yeah. After Biden belatedly dropped out, James and I thought he should have dropped out a year earlier, by almost by default, Kamala Harris, not their strongest candidate, took over. As James has said, if the Philadelphia Eagles went with their fourth team quarterback, they would not have won the Super Bowl. And I'm not sure she could have won, but I just want to bounce off of you because you certainly get into this. She made two colossal mistakes, I thought. One, not striking some distance from Biden, not in an October interview, but at the August convention when people were watching her and getting to know her. Simply saying, I'm very proud of our record, but we do have some differences, especially on affordability and the cost of living. She did not do that. And the other was her choice of Tim Walz, rejecting Josh Shapiro, who Republicans feared the most, as you all write. And they said not good chemistry between Harris and Shapiro. The Pennsylvania governor was too aggressive. In 1960, Lyndon Johnson was a hell of a lot more aggressive than Josh Shapiro and had no chemistry with Jack Kennedy. But JFK picked him because he needed to win. She failed that test, too, Josh.
Well, I happen to be with a lot of the senior Trump folks when the Walz announcement came out, just by happenstance. And, I mean, they were thrilled. I mean, the Trump folks were literally thrilled. I mean, they, Chris LaCivita, Susie Wiles, his core team, thought Josh Shapiro would be a challenging person to run against. They thought he could be more difficult. Not that they thought they would lose, but they thought he was going to be much more challenging. And I think they believe from day one, the Trump side, that Walz was a gift to them. I mean, I happened to see it in real time, some of their reactions. Also, on the other point that you made on the no distance, I mean, there were lots of discussions. We obtained some memos from the book when various folks from the Harris campaign came up with ideas on how could you create distance from the president. What could you do? What could you say? What would it work? And she just wasn't interested. I mean, she wasn't interested. And you know that famous clip on The View where she says, you know, there's nothing I would do differently What we report in the book is that during a commercial break, one of our top aides goes to the View host and says, can you ask that question again? Can we try a different answer? And they ended up not doing it. But they realized sort of in that moment that being linked to Biden in such a dramatic way was not good.
The fourth team quarterback. You know, finally, before turning over to James, the Trump team deserves enormous credit for locking up the nomination early and just taking over the Republican Party. But in the general election against mediocre opposition, he managed to win by a little more than a point, the smallest margin by a winning candidate in more than a half century. It was not a big, impressive victory in that sense. Yet they've been able to claim a huge mandate, Josh.
Yeah, but I guess what we'll see is how the American public reacts to that in the midterms, right? I mean, he pushed he calls it the big, beautiful bill through Congress, but the numbers are not very high on that right now. Can they make that popular? Right. Some of his other things that he's doing, I don't know, are broadly popular. So they're claiming this mandate. And so far, you see the Republican Party totally behind him. I mean, there are no more, you know, Bob Corkers, there are no more Jeff Flakes, or is no one speaking out saying, you know, Tom Tillis, I guess, is a lone exception here and maybe masking in the House, but most of these guys are totally gone and everyone's following Trump and he's claiming this mandate on all of these issues across the board. I guess the jury's still out on whether or not the American public will want that to continue.
James. So Josh, this program is probably more than anything else, was consistent in its view that Biden shouldn't run for re-election. We were consistent and we were vocal. All right.
We were.
We have a point of disagreement, Al and I do. I want you to weigh in on it. Biden gets out July the 21st. And I had written 2 weeks earlier there should be a competitive process that President Clinton and Obama should invite to have town halls and have like a cattle call and the class Chicago Open, all right? On the 21st, I think they could have tried something. Al said it was too late. They had no other choice but to go with Harris. I think that's the parameters of the disagreement we had. In your mind, could a process be set up or something could be done to have some kind of a competitive process for the nomination between July the 21st and the start of the convention?
But I think if they really wanted to, sure. I mean, you change the rules, you move heaven and earth, you do it, right? That's what the Democrats certainly told us at the time and in the reporting for this book. But one of the reasons there was no competitive primaries, there was no time. They couldn't have done it. But I mean, you guys have both been around for a long time and watched a lot of things. People always say they can't do things unless they really want to do them, and then they try to do them, right? I think early on when Biden's getting out, there are luminaries in the party who believe, we talk about Pelosi a little bit in the book. We talk about, you know, others who believe there could have been a primary. They wanted to see a primary.
On the 21st.
Right. They believe there could have been a primary.
God, James, my favorite Gamecock voted against me.
Well, Al, I tried not to vote against you. I tried to give a diplomatic answer that no one was mad about.
It's one of these things that it just stimulates the thought process. So I want to talk about Mike and Biden. They seem to be, would you agree that this was principally Biden, I'm going to do it, and Mike was the kind of enforcer here, and this is what's going to happen, and we're going to do this at all costs? Is that your sense?
And Ricchetti,
okay. Mike Donlan, just so people know, was one of the three best political consultants I ever knew in my life. When I was doing this for a living, he was the number one guy. He was a good pollster. He was a great strategist. He had clear level judgment. And I think, and I'm going to ask you to react to this, that there was this, we don't get any goddamn respect. We're two Irish guys here. You right. Did all of this. The fucking Obama people didn't mm-hmm. like you. The Clinton people thought they had reinvented the wheel. And goddamn it, you showed them and we're going to show them again. Did that kind of bunker mentality play into this?
100%. I mean, I think that's a lot of what happened here. In 2016, you know, Obama didn't want Biden to run. Then later, you know, there's questions from Obama and others, should should Biden run? There are people who've underestimated Biden, I think, for his whole career. People told him he couldn't do this, he couldn't do that. I think he certainly had a chip on his shoulder about that. And I think Donilon and Rachetti did as well, 100%.
Man, you look back at this and you just marvel at how smart people all drank the same Kool-Aid. And that's what they were drinking, this fucking Kool-Aid, all right? I mean, I know that. And Mike, so Al has an observation, and I'll flush it out. I think I agree with him. There were more employees than advisors.
That's right.
So Clinton, I can't tell you the number of times that he said, I don't want that fucking guy around me anymore, James. All he does is agree with me. I mean, that was just part of the, but I don't think there was that kind of culture in the Biden inner circle where you disagree, but you, all right, okay.
Yeah, there wasn't. And I think the folks who disagreed near the end, were totally blocked out. I mean, when one of the pollsters we have in the book, Jeff Guerin, comes in and gives a presentation to the top aides about, you know, sort of how dire things look, Rachetti tells him, you know, your job was to tell us how we could win. It was not to deliver bad news like that. And, you know, Pete Aguilar, we quote in the book, is going, you know, to Rachetti and saying, you know, we're going to lose all these seats in the House. We're going to lose all these seats in the Senate. You guys realize how bad it is. And Rachetti says, no one's telling us that. He goes, well, you tell the president. Schumer in the book sort of complains to others that he doesn't think anything he's saying to Biden's top aides is actually getting to the president. I mean, there wasn't room for dissent. I mean, one of the things we have, I think, is just kind of an amazing anecdote. Adrian Elrod, who was on the campaign, one of, you know, longtime Democratic consultant, there's concern about, you know, none of the money's coming in after the debate. They can't raise money anymore. Polling's looking bad. There's concern they can't get to Biden. So what does Adrienne Elrod do? She calls Morning Joe, tells Morning Joe what they wanted to say on air the next morning because they think Biden's going to be watching it while he's at the gym working out, right? I mean, there was a lot of folks who were really, really frustrated by the fact that dissent was not really allowed in Biden's inner circle.
So I'll turn it out, but you know what I used to call Jeff Guerin when I was running campaign? Eeyore. He'd love to tell you bad news.
he learned that from his mentor, Peter Hart.
When they're telling you bad news. He and Greenberg, too.
Go ahead. I got old Peter Hart memos. He was our pollster at the Wall Street Journal, Josh. And nobody was better at delivering bad news than Peter. I'm going to come back to Biden in a minute, but on your chapter on one chapter on Trump called Paranoia, but even apart from the Butler shooting, there was cause for paranoia, I gather, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, the Iranians wanted Trump dead. I mean, when the FBI and the intelligence community briefed Trump's top aides, they said they're trying to get, you know, kill squads in the country to take you out. You know, they were flying decoy planes. A lot of times the Secret Service was trying. The Secret Service, their main concern with Trump was that Trump had the same patterns. He went to the same few places. He went at the same times every week, right? The golf course, his own clubs. You know, he didn't really do things that were unpredictable. And so they were trying to, you know, change things up a little bit, right? I mean, one of the things that's in the book, they have a lot of fear. They're driving in Pennsylvania, leaving an event, and there's a drone trailing the motorcade for like 30, 45 minutes. Can't shake the drone, right? There are other times where Secret Service tells folks from the Trump campaign, you know, we're going to board the plane differently underneath, you know, a hangar instead of like we usually do, right? We want people to get on in certain ways. I mean, there was, you know, anytime you're sort of afraid of threats after, you know, the bullet hit his ear and then the other guy who was found, you know, in the golf club and in the bushes, you know, you always then probably are a little more paranoid. But according to the briefings that Trump's folks were getting from the government, there was also reason to be paranoid.
You talked about Steve Rachetti and Mike Donilon. I just want to ask you about a couple more. The power couple who were so celebrated were Anita Dunn and her husband, Bob Bauer. Anita Dunn led the case for an early debate. Bob Bauer allowed the special counsel to interview Biden for 5 hours over 2 days. I think those both were cases of political malpractice, and they deserve to be the criticism they're getting. I'm gonna, if you disagree, please tell me. And I read in your book about Ron Klain, he seems to have it both ways. I mean, I'll read one chapter and Ron Klain is saying, you know, really he ought to get out. And then at the end, no, he ought to stay in. So just give me your reactions to those three.
Yeah, well, the argument that Anita Dunn and others, we obtained this sort of 6-page memo that they sent Biden on the debates. And what they say to him in this memo is, you know, we believe you will be able to reach the widest possible audience early in the debate. You're able, you know, to show America that you're better than Trump. You're able to expose some of what he is. You know, and they say, quote unquote, while there's no perfect time to schedule a debate, we have identified an ideal window in late June for the first debate. And they wanted him to debate early. Now, I will say, maybe I'll get in trouble for saying this, but I will say, I think that's somewhat evidence that there wasn't this cover up in every way that some other folks have alleged, right? If you really believe that your principal from some of these folks are so out of it and so addled and can't make sentences, do you say, I want you to debate early for an hour and a half on live TV so we can do two or three debates? I mean, there is something good there point. That's kind of interesting, right? But the memo, the her, one of the things that's in the book is that when Robert Herr is interviewing Biden, and Biden's memory is really bad on everything, Herr leaves the first night, it's a 2-day interview, and says to others at the Department of Justice and FBI, you know, we can't figure out if he's playing us or not. He can't answer any of the questions. Is this a game? Is this an act? I mean, he was stunned at how bad his memory was. And it sort of tells you how long some of these Biden folks had been with him and how desensitized they were, because they sat through the same interview and Bauer and crew thought it went fine.
Jeez. You know, Hunter Biden was a figure in the president's mind throughout all this, the very troubled son who was facing criminal charges. I'm just can't get over this. If Biden had gotten out in 2023, as he should have, and been a bridge, as he once said he was going to be, I think, I don't know, the Hunter problems would have gone away, but they sure as hell would have been eased. And they never seem to realize that, Josh.
Yeah, that's right. And Biden was obsessed with the Hunter situation. I mean, folks close to him said he believed that, you know, they were going after Hunter to get him and that he was sort of responsible for some of Hunter's problems. And that after living a pretty sordid and dark and, you know, drug-filled life, Hunter Biden had gotten back on the right track, and he thought it was, you know, highly unfair what was happening to him. And in 2024, as sort of the foreign trips are happening, as he's raising money, as he's preparing for the debate, several people told us for the book that he was fixated on Hunter's trial. He called Abby Lowell, Hunter's lawyer, and said, can I come testify on behalf of my son? I mean, can you guys imagine what a spectacular, remarkable moment that would be if the president of the United States flew to Delaware and got on the defense stand for his son? But he wanted to testify, right? He was concerned about his son's money. He was trying to figure out how to make sure everything was paid for. He was talking to Hunter all the time, and Hunter was joining calls with White House officials. I mean, one of the scenes in the book is that you know, they're doing this call when the Supreme Court rules on immunity, right, and says presidents can be immune for any official act. They're figuring out how Biden should respond, and all of a sudden a voice pipes in that no one knows who it is, and it's Hunter. And the White House counsel's office, you know, is, why is Hunter Biden on this call discussing how he responds to his decision? But Hunter was just a major figure in his dad's life. And Biden's defenders would say, of course, you know, he's a loving father. He loves his son. His son was in a horrible predicament. But to White House aides, it was a point of frustration because they couldn't talk about it, right? Biden didn't want to talk about his son's criminal problems. He didn't want to talk about how it affected his election. I mean, one of the scenes in the book was they come in to brief. The White House is trying to put together a briefing for Biden and Joe Biden about what all is going to happen with Hunter in 2023 and 2024, or what could happen. And Biden just wasn't interested in talking about it.
Well, I admire his love for his son, but I will always think if he'd gotten out when he should have, it might have been a lot easier. Let me ask one final question and then turn it over to James. You know, as James mentioned, throughout 2023, we both railed against Biden running again. I wrote several columns. I think it was a cataclysmic mistake. It was a mistake for his legacy, for his party, and it gave us Trump. But I think it's nonsense when I hear Republicans and even some journalists say this was worse than Watergate. That would be true only if there were examples of dangerous decisions or poor policies that were made due to his clear cognitive slippage. But yet, I haven't read anything on that, including in your excellent book. I think this was more a tragedy than a scandal.
I would see a lot of it as a tragedy, you know, as well. I think a lot of our sources saw it that way. I'm not, you know, comparing it to Watergate. I think what our book showed, frankly, was there were good days where Biden struggled to remember names of senators and wasn't particularly, you know, with it in meetings. And there were also days where he was much sharper. I mean, one of the final scenes in the book, he's meeting with Trump after the election. They have a 90-minute wide-ranging discursive meeting, and Trump walks out and says to Susie Wiles, where was that guy during the debate, right? I mean, Biden was much sharper that day and quite good, according to, you know, what the way they saw it. So,
but you guys didn't come up with any, you know, really bad policy decisions made because he was losing it. He was not mentally there.
Think we write about any sort of bad policy decisions because he was losing it. I think we write sort of about his acuity at times. But I mean, frankly, yeah. You know, Al, this was sort of a campaign book, and we didn't really dive into every single policy decision made in the White House and what a lot of that was about, right? We focused mainly on the campaign.
James Carville.
So, Josh, let's go to me, the most important date in the modern Democratic Party, and that is July the 21st, the year 2024. Take us a little bit through, when did the president notify the vice president that he wasn't going to run? How was the decision made that they were just going to keep the same manager, the same strategist, the same headquarters, the same furniture, the same phone number, the same everything, which was a colossal disaster there? So, What happened? When did Biden notify Harris? Take us through this.
Biden notified her around lunchtime that day, on that Sunday. It was a Sunday right after the RNC debate had just finished. And Harris and her team immediately started working the phones to try and solidify support with the Democratic Party, calling all of the sort of movers and shakers, you know, Pelosi and Schumer and Newsom and Pritzker and, you know, both trying to avoid a primary and to get folks to come out and support them. And they made a decision that day that they didn't have time to totally reinvent the wheel, that they didn't have time to move everyone from Wilmington down to D.C., that they didn't have time to go through all the hiring processes for new campaign managers, new officials, new everything. And for a while, I mean, some of the same, you know, slogans and things were on the walls in the headquarters in Wilmington, which was pretty, you know, surreal for the folks who were working there. And her bet was, we're going to keep it the same way. We're going to try to just pull this off through the same people on July 21st. You know, we have a photo that we sort of obtained for the book. We didn't publish in the book because we ended up not doing photos. But it's this photo taken inside the vice president's residence on July 21st after they've made all these calls. And she's wearing a Howard sweatshirt. She's, you know, it's a Sunday afternoon, right? And they're all standing there and they're smiling. And, you know, someone described the photo to us as they thought they were making history. I mean, in that moment, they thought when Biden was getting out of the race and she was in, that she was going to be able to pull this off.
Well, the consequences, and one of the things that I'll say just editorialized before we put a great interview and a great book, people have cultures. The Clinton people are not the Obama people. The Obama people are not the Biden people, okay? It just doesn't work, all right? It's not that the Clinton people didn't vote for Obama. Of course they did. It's not that the Obama people didn't vote for Harris or Biden. Of course they did. But you got to have your own people, man. It's just that you might be in the same political party, but it's a that's a different world. It's a different culture. And they didn't understand that.
Well, and also in that moment, you know, Jen O'Malley Dillon, who was the campaign manager, you know, she brought in, Harris brought in a few people later as senior advisors, you know, the David Plouffe, Stephanie Cutter, various folks. But she thought in that moment that Jen O'Malley Dillon was who, you know, she should keep. And I'm going to let you make opinions on it, and I'm just going to say what happened.
I mean, I understand the impulse, but it just does not, you know, maybe she didn't have people. I don't know. But it was the same culture, the campaign. It was the same headquarters. And I've read, I think it's true, that Biden said he didn't want her getting any distance between her and him when she ran.
Well, he called her on the day of a debate and said that. The day of the debate, he said, you know, you got to remember I'm popular in Pennsylvania. You know, I'm hearing there are people that are trying to tell you to back away from me. You know, we've done a lot of good things in this administration. You should be touting them.
Oh, God. Oh, man. What a great book. What a what a series of really catastrophic decisions here. But you got a chronicle of facts, and congratulations.
He's done it. Josh, before we go, I'm going to tell you my favorite University of South Carolina story. You'll remember there was a Louisiana congressman named David Vitter, Republican, who was a very deceitful philanderer and womanizer. And Nikki Haley, in a speech in Washington, said, in South Carolina, we call our state university the Gamecocks. In Washington, that's what you call David Vitter. Anyway, Josh, this is a marvelous book, 2024. You and your co-authors have done a terrific job. Everybody out there, if you want to read one book, I think there are several good ones, but I think this may well be the best. And Josh Dawsey, as I told you, when you join the Wall Street Journal, we know the revolution is over. You are a fabulous reporter. Thank you.
Thank you. In Washington or any other place that you are, somebody that's feeling better than you is going to be sharper than you, is going to be more on their toes, and you want to be everything you can. And if you got to work at night, or maybe you don't have to work at night, maybe you like to have a few drinks at night. Okay, I no problem with that. But, you know, what you want to do is you want to be on your best the next day. And this stuff will give you the boost that you need, even when you're slowing down a little bit. You need it.
Yeah.
Important.
Well, you know, you raise a good point, because after a night with drinks, we usually don't bounce back like we used to. It used to be a big decision. Do you want a great night or a great next day? Luckily, with pre-alcohol, you don't have to compromise. To fill you in, ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Now, here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's the buildup of this byproduct, not dehydration, that's a blame for rough days after drinking. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme that breaks this byproduct down. Just remember, you really have to make pre-alcohol your first drink of the night. Then drink responsibly, and you're going to feel your best the next day. Thanks to ZBiotic, James even goes on long runs after his long nights. Every time you have ZBiotics pre-alcohol before a drink, it makes a difference. Whether you're writing all day, exercising, or even going in front of an audience, ZBiotics is the MVP when it counts. After all, summer's here, which means more opportunities to celebrate the warm weather. So before the backyard barbecue brew, a glass of Pinot, watching the sunset at the beach, or a cocktail by the campfire, don't forget your ZBiotics pre-alcohol. Just drink one before drinking and wake up feeling great and ready to take on the next day and all the summer has to offer. Go to ZBiotics.com/PWR to learn more and get 15% off your first order when you use PWR at checkout. ZBiotics is back with 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/PWR and use the code PWR at checkout for 15% off. The link is in our show notes.
You're your best after a night out with Z-Biotics.
And now for the outrage. James, I was ecstatic in 2005 when Major League Baseball returned to Washington after a 34-year hiatus. And I took my son to the first game. I am a season ticket holder, as are you. And I think Stan Kasten and then Mike Rizzo built this franchise. And we had many, many thrills. Few disappointments, but more thrills. Really culminating in winning the World Series in 2019 as an underdog wildcard team. That's as great as it gets. Stars ranging from a kid named Juan Soto to veterans like Howie Kendrick, Max Scherzer, Steven Strasburg, Sean Doolittle. You were in Los Angeles when we beat the Dodgers there and went on to defeat the former world champions Astro. But since 2019, the picture has been darker, with the second worst record in Major League Baseball. Thus, the firing this week of general manager Rizzo and manager Davey Martinez was not unexpected. We owe them a lot for what they've done, and this is the way the game is. I think the bigger problem, however, are the owners, the Lerner family, who've gone cheap. Low payroll, insufficient scouting staff, rated by one analyst as the worst managed franchise in baseball. They are billionaires, very proud of developing projects like Tyson's Corner. Learners, get prouder of your 2019 World Champion Nationals. Dig in your pockets and support a winning franchise or sell the team. You owe that to your fans.
Yeah, you're right. And I don't like to know combined how much money we've spent with the Nationals since 2005. I don't want to look at it. But to be fair, I love baseball. I love baseball in attendance. But boy, this is not a good effort at all. And I like Mike Rizzo. He was there from 2009. I mean, it was that's a long time to last in professional sports in any position. I'm a little bit past on the outrage to just reinforce something I already said. Trump's stupidity never ceases to amaze me. And his comment about a 100-year weather event has got to be the dumb in a sea of stupidity to me. Just stands out as a Mount Suribachi or something for being so stupid.
Oh, of course, he may say something even stupider next week, James.
He can see it and he can raise it.
Yeah.
You're only as good as your ingredients. I can tell you that. I don't care who you are. You can be Paul Bocuse or Paul Poudon, but you ain't going anywhere without good ingredients.
Yeah, yeah. And whole grain doesn't need to mean half taste. If you've tried store-bought healthy breads and bagels, you know that most of the time they might as well be made from recycled cardboard. So when the artisan bakers at Royo sent us their variety box of quote-unquote healthy breads and bagels, you know, we fully expected it to be dry and boring. Fact check, that could not be more wrong. Royo's offerings taste amazing. You're going to want to try everything they have when you hear about the best part. Everything is baked fresh daily with super clean and minimal ingredients. Plus, it's all low in carbs with really higher fiber and protein than you're used to. Some of their products only have 2 net carbs. So if you're like James and me, and you always want to keep looking summer ready, Royo is for you. The keto cinnamon raisin bagels are a huge hit. I know so many people who would eat the whole bag when they find out how good they are. But it's something you should find out for yourself. After all, Royo breads are so good, you'll forget they're healthier than the other stuff out there. Plus, we got you 20% off. Just go to eatroyo.com and use our promo code PWR for your 20% off. That's promo code PWR at EatRoyo, ROYO.com. The link also is in our show notes.
Anybody that has any interest in good tasting food should try this product. I highly recommend it because bread is like anything else. Some of it is really good and some of it is really bad. Get the good grains with Royo.
Hey, now for questions from our listeners. We love these questions. They are so good. The most difficult decision of the week is choosing which ones to use. Shane in Minneapolis, Minnesota, James, wants to say, what are the best polls to look at? Where do we find them?
Well, I'm going to Minneapolis weekend of the 19th. Paul Begala's oldest son's getting married at the Art Museum, and I'm having dinner at Manny's, one of my favorite steakhouses in the entire United States, with a lot of good friends I have up there. So I could talk about Minneapolis forever, but I'm coming. You know, the best polls, we obviously like the Wall Street Journal poll. You're the kind of originator of it. I still think that it's a reason to believe it's a really good poll. I'm kind of a fan of the polling averages. And, it's like everything else. Some get better, some get worse. And I generally rely on, I know so many people, I tend to trust private polling because it's more expensive. But I do think the Wall Street Journal is a very well-conducted poll. I think the polling, I would look at the Wall Street Journal poll, I'd look at polling averages and just see. And when they're pretty much in alignment, you can be pretty confident that you're getting good information. But I just don't stay on top of it enough to tell you today there's this hotshot public poll out there that you hadn't heard of that I know of. I don't know that. They might be.
Yeah, I agree. And, we both were at Harvard a couple of days before the election. We both thought Harris was going to win. That was a little bit of a hope. But also the polls were very, very close. She lost by 1.3 points. You can't measure that. I mean, if you have a poll that shows a 1-point margin, okay, I'd rather be one ahead maybe than one behind. But, there's a plus or minus there. So, look at them, and I think the overall trends are what's most important.
Yeah, and you're so right. And by the way, the margin of error is a real thing.
Right.
It's a mathematical certainty. Now, its greater chance is plus or minus one than plus or minus 3.5, but still, I thought the reason that I publicly wrote that I thought she was going to win was based on the fact that the polling was tied, and I thought that she had all of the intangibles except for one, which I was kind of seeming not to recognize. Trump became the change candidate in a campaign that wanted change, but Harris had more money, had more organization, had more surrogates, had all of the things that we would describe as having some effect on the margins in politics, didn't turn out to have no effect.
Yeah.
So that's important. But the polling was fine. The polling was spot on in 2022. There have been polling flubs. I admit that. And, by the way, 1 in 20 are going to be fucking wrong. I don't care who it is that takes the poll, and you got to realize that too. But it's a good question. I wish we had more definitive answer for it.
Yeah, I remember in 2016, I got a lot of flack when I was running the Bloomberg poll with Ann Seltzer, and our final poll had Hillary Clinton winning by, 2.7 points, and we rounded it up to 3. And people said, oh, boy, you blew that one. You really missed it. Well, the fact is she won by, 2.2 or 2.3. Yeah, we were 0.4% off. I mean, really.
Yeah, it's a lot of stupidity that goes pulling them out.
Tommy in Marietta, Georgia asked, good question. What components of the big, beautiful bill can Democrats fix through reconciliation the next time a Democrat is president and controls the legislative branch? Tommy, that's, first of all, 4 years away at best, okay? In the meantime, not a whole lot you can do in the next year and a half other than try to offer amendments. You can do that more easily in the Senate, but you can do it to some extent in the House and embarrass the Republicans to defend some of these atrocities. And if they bring up, they try to fix some of this stuff, don't help them. I mean, you try to make your fixes. And it's critical to win the midterms because then you have some leverage with the appropriations process. But there's so many bad things in this bill, it's going to take a long time, well beyond 2029 to fix.
So people like to focus on it, you know, oh, the Democrats are kind of divided. You know, look at what happened in New York City. Oh, look, you know, look how different that is, what happened in Virginia. And there's a whole generational movement that's impatient. And there's this urban rural split, and there's this split and that split, and God knows what. There is one thing, one big thing that the entire Democratic Party will rally around, and that is the awfulness of the Big Beautiful Bill.
Right.
We do not need to talk about another goddamn thing between now and November of 2026. I mean, nothing else. Not challenging people in primaries, not talking about where it is. It's all going to get flushed out where it should get flushed out, and that is when we go to nominate a president. But between this date and election day in 2026, we should talk about nothing but getting rid of this and examples and offering amendments and making them take votes. This thing is the lowest single piece of congressional legislation in the history of fucking polling.
Right.
Don't talk about anything else.
Right.
Don't talk about generational change. Don't talk about any of that. Do that when you need to during 2027 and 2028, but not now. The party, every segment, every corner, every nook and cranny, everything in the Democratic Party is complete, and the voters are, and by the way, the swing voters are, the independents are, and more
young,
than just
young voters. No, I know. I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, if you want more, if you want to be buttressed more than that, again, I'll repeat for the fourth time, read the Larry Summers essay in the New York Times this week. James, Rick in Gig Harbor, Washington, asks, will Elon Musk's American Party increase or lessen the chances of Democrats taking the House or Senate next year?
Oh, I mean, first of all, it's almost they're going to have trouble fielding congressional candidates. And there is this observation, and I think it has some validity, that the legislatures and parties make it harder for third parties, but the problems could be ballot access and everything.
Yep.
I mean, people just got to understand, you just don't, it's not like running for the town council where you get up one day and say, I'm going to go down to courthouse, register. It's a little more complicated. And remember, American elections are not an election, it's 50 different elections. And it's not going to change. I don't think that thing is going to do very much. I don't know what's the difference between it and the Libertarian Party, but other than it's got Elon Musk's name, I'm sure that with this kind of money, they'll merge. And, you know, Libertarians can cost Republicans elections. They have plenty of times when you go back in somebody's close Senate and House races that the Libertarian Party, you know, I don't know the number of times I've had somebody say, well, we can't get bad news, we can't get to 50. The good news, we don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you can conclude it possibly could do some damage when they can get on the ballot, the presidential thing.
James, I color me skeptical, but I think to the extent they do get on ballots, it won't be in very many in 2026. I think it's more likely to hurt Republican candidates than Democratic candidates in most places.
I completely agree with you.
Right. Stephen in San Jose, California. I love this question, James. Asked, Republican Derek Van Orden from Wisconsin said that he and other Republicans, quote, aren't a bunch of little bitches, end quote, just going along with this big, beautiful bill. Then they turned around and voted for the bill. Does this make Derek Van Orden Trump's little bitch? Hey, that's good, Stephen. I agree. I think you have a number of little bitches, but why don't we designate Congressman Van Orden as the chief little bitch, since he brought it up?
You know, my observations, I look at this guy, he looks like he's drunk all the time, to be honest with you. But maybe I'm seeing something wrong, but I think that guy's drank a beer or two in his life.
James, Jeff in St. Pete, Florida, asked a question that some are asking. Why are Democrats fighting so hard for DEI? Don't we have bigger winning issues?
Why repeat the question? DEI?
Yeah. Why are Democrats fighting so hard for DEI?
They don't. And everybody is trying to get away from it. I read a story. AOC has scrubbed her site of pronouns. All right. Everybody knows this has been a big, giant, massive disaster. And I don't think, you know, I think there are two kinds of people in this debate. There are people like me that said, this is a disaster and we're still trying to watch the stench of this shit off. Every year that goes by, we get a little bit of a less stench. It was really stupid. Then you have people say, well, it probably wasn't that great idea, but no one talks about it, so it didn't hurt us in the election. Bullshit. It hurt us in the election. The whole thing hurt us. It hurt the image of the party. No one that I know of is really promoting this crap anymore. Maybe it's a couple of museums and foundations. That's about all that's left of this nonsense.
Yeah, I have always thought that more diversity, inclusion, and equity is a good thing. But what it was taken to extremes. It became, you know, kind of a woke litmus test, and that becomes a not so good thing. And right now, it's again, it goes back to what James said a few minutes ago. There are other bigger issues, principally the big ugly bill, to focus on for Democrats.
I need to clean something up here. When I was going on this rant about DEI, what it was really at the core of it was the whole identity politics movement, right, of which clearly DEI was a part of. But do I think that diversity should be a part of everything? I obviously do. A long time ago, I worked in the mayor's office in East Baton Rouge and Baton Rouge. It was a long time ago, but you know, it didn't had not hired a single black fireman in its existence. Well, shit, you just got to, you know, and the court correctly said, you got to go hire 20 right now. And I agree with that. So the DEI was conflating that with a lot of the identity movement, but the idea, and all you had these people coming up saying how not to be this, and they were shaking companies down, they were doing seminars on how to not be a racist and stuff, and people resented it. And I can understand that. No one wants to sit on a Saturday morning being mandated to be told you're some kind of awful human being. That part was a racket. But yeah. I generally want to be clear. I'm generally supportive of any effort to bring more diversity to any organization.
Yeah. Me too. Don in Saginaw, Texas says, does the military consider climate issues when making long-term plans? If they do, how does this impact their funding with a climate denier as commander-in-chief? Yeah, actually they have. I mean, the military's, causes a lot of the climate problems because they're big and they, you know, fly a lot of planes and drive a lot of trucks and tanks and everything. But they've been very sensitive to this issue for years, and they have factored that into their planning. That is going to come to largely to a halt with Donald Trump and the incredibly unqualified Pete Hegseth, as long as he stays in the Defense Department, because this is a long-term problem, and Trump doesn't care about the long-term. He just cares about himself and his riches and tomorrow.
So there's a group, you know, Pentagon has all these, like, top, you know, if you're thinking about threats. It identified the biggest future threat to peace around the world and to the United States was the displacement of people that lived in deltaic areas due to subsidence and sea level rise. Okay, now stop and think of what they're saying. So I live in a great example, New Orleans, which is definitely being affected by sea level rise, subsidence, climate, everything. We're not that big a place. All right, we just thought population-wise, we're relatively small. Try to move Lagos, Nigeria. Mm-hmm. Okay, you want to see some security problems, or any places like in Southeast Asia, people like in Bangladesh or India, that are really being adversely affected by this. People in on the east coast of China, particularly being affected by it. I mean, this is a problem that's going to cause the world unbelievable grief, and they can't know it. And of course, and again, we talk about Trump and this. He does not. He's too. I think the man is genuinely stupid, but that's just what I think.
James, we have a perfect final question from Barbara in Norwich, Vermont. She said, will James Carville please sit down with David Hogg and convince him to hammer away on the so-called big, beautiful bill? After 2026, maybe 2028, Hogg can press on with other issues that he and many of us may hold dear. But Hogg has something to offer, and James Carville is the premier political strategist. So, James, set up a meeting.
I talked to him. I tried. The one problem I have, and I will always have, and I will never get over it, is if you're an official of the DNC, you should not, ethically, morally, or any other reason, encourage other Democrats to run against Democrats. I don't think we should do it as a matter of principle in this season coming up. I think David Hogg or James Carville or Paul James or any other fucking person has one job, and that is to beat this. But it, never, ever, ever would I agree that a person working for an organization can actually betray what the organization is about, and that's winning elections to Democrats. I really don't think David gets some horrendous advice, I think his strategy is not very enlightened.
Well, never has that been more important than right now, facing the kind of threat that America faces. Listen, we love those letters, emails, we really do. Please keep them coming. If we didn't get to yours this week, we'll try to get to it next week. Thank you. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Beam, ZBiotics, and Royo, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. And remember to go over to our show notes to vote. You have one more week to vote on the worst of the worst of Trump appointees. So make your voice heard. Speak up. Go to our show notes and you can vote on the worst of the Trump appointees. You also can find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate this show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.